Good morning, everyone.
Okay.
It's 9 o'clock, and I think we want to get started. We have a very full agenda today. We're splitting it in half. The first hour will be about long-term contracts, and in the second hour, we will hear from Xcel and talk about some of their plans. So with that, I would like to get started and get to it right away. For those who do not know, Bob Eliff is part of our nonpartisan House research, and he will start us off.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Chair asked me to prepare some general background introductory remarks regarding the discussion of all requirements contracts that we'll have a little bit later, so that's what this will be about. There are three functions that any electric utility has to play in serving its customers. First, it has to get electricity, either generated through its own facilities or procured from other facilities, either in Minnesota or in other states. Second, it has to transport that electricity from the point at which it's generated to the location where its load is. And finally, it has to distribute that electricity to individual customers, every individual retail customers. And in Minnesota and elsewhere, where there are three distinct types of utility organizations that have developed to perform these three functions. The ones we're most familiar with here are investor-owned utilities, which are called public utilities in the state statutes. Xcel Energy, Minnesota Power, Ottertail. These organizations do all those three functions. They own generating facilities. They also procure electricity from other generating facilities. They own the transmission that brings electricity to their customers. And finally, they own the distribution system that brings the electricity directly to individual retail customers. And these IOUs account for about 60% of the total retail sales in Minnesota, and they serve about 1.5 million customers. The second form of organization that provides electricity are municipal utilities, which, as the name implies, are organized on a city basis. You can see, and there are 125 of them in Minnesota. You can see this chart in your packets shows that they are distributed throughout the state. Unlike IOUs, municipal utilities are not price regulated by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, although they are subject to other regulations. Half of the munis are governed by city councils and half by local public utilities commissions, whose members are in most cases appointed by city councils, although there are a few cities that elect local public utility officials, Austin and Blue Earth among them. As I said, there are 125 munis in Minnesota. They serve about 357,000 customers and account for about 15% in state sales. Most of them are very small, except for Rochester and Duluth. More than 80% of them have fewer than 5,000 customers. And the three functions that I described are performed by two different kinds of municipal utilities. The ones in the cities themselves focus on distribution only. They get the electricity to individual customers at the retail level. The generation, pure procurement, and the transmission functions are performed by other organizations, which are called municipal power associations, or MPAs, which serve multiple munis in a geographic area. And in Minnesota, there are half a dozen of these MPAs, and you can tell by their names what areas they serve. There's the Western Minnesota Municipal Power Association, and also the Southern and the Northern and the Central. And there's the plain old Minnesota Municipal Power Association, which works in South Central Minnesota, Anoka, Buffalo, Chaska, and out to East Grand Forks. And finally, there's the Heartland Power District, which also has municipal customers in South Central Minnesota, as in New Ulm and Lake Crystal. These MPAs are subject to some Public Utilities Commission regulation, such as the Renewable Energy Standard and the Integrated Resource Planning Process. And the third method of organization of delivering service to Minnesota customers are electric cooperatives. Like the munis, these are not price regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, although they are subject to other PUC regulations. And these organizations, of which there are 45 in Minnesota, are managed by a board of directors that's elected by the members, the customers who are served, and it's these boards of directors that actually set the rates that electric cooperatives charge to their customers. They serve collectively about 750,000 customers in Minnesota. And as you can see from this map again, in the blue area, they cover 85% of the land area of Minnesota. Like the munis, the three functions are split up for electric co-ops. The co-ops themselves, again, focus solely on distribution, whereas other cooperative organizations focus on the generation and transmission functions. And in fact, they're called generation and transmission co-ops, G&Ts. And their members are the individual distribution co-ops that provide electricity directly to retail customers. If you look at the second map in your packet here with the different colors, it shows which areas the G&T co-ops serve. The largest one, of course, is Great River Energy, that gray swath from the northeast down through central Minnesota to the south. In the northwest is Minn Kota. East Central and Basin Electric are in the west central and southwest, and Dairyland in the southeast. These MPAs cover, and the electric co-ops that they serve cover about 25% of the total sales in Minnesota. And the G&Ts are also subject to PUC regulation like Renewable Energy Standard and the IRP as well. So we're here today to talk a little bit about what are called all requirements contracts. And like many things about utilities, where do they come from? They came because of economics, okay? MPAs and G&Ts need to raise large amounts of capital to provide the energy infrastructure that they need to get power to customers, power plants and transmission lines. These things are very expensive. They can take a generation or more to pay off. And in order to secure financing, a borrower must have a long-term guaranteed stream of income sufficient to service the debt. If the individual co-ops and munis were free to choose suppliers, the future income stream of their G&Ts and MPAs would be less predictable, putting at risk its ability to retire that debt. And that results in either a higher interest rate for the loan or no loan at all. Co-ops have historically obtained capital from the federal government, from the Rural Utility Service, which is the successor to the Rural Electricity Administration, which helped spread electrification to rural areas in the 1930s and 1940s. In fact, until about the last 10 years or so, all retirements contracts were a prerequisite in order to obtain a loan from the federal government. Another benefit of this guaranteed income stream also allows rates to be kept low by reducing the required equity ratio for a G&T or an MPA. For example, I was told this about 7 or 8 years ago by somebody at an MPA, and I think it still holds. They're only required to keep, say, an equity ratio of about 20% compared to 40 to 50% for their individual member cooperatives. So the G&Ts or the MPAs can use their own equity for investment rather than going out into the market and borrowing capital and paying interest, which, of course, have to be reflected in costs. So the result of an all-requirements contract is that MPAs typically allow no flexibility from them except continuing purchasing of low-cost power from the Western Area Power Association for those utilities that are located in the western part of the state. That's a federal power marketing agency that existed when those members first joined MPAs. Co-ops, on the other hand, have provided some flexibility from all requirements contracts in recent years. For example, Dairyland allows its member co-ops to obtain their own supplies for up to 10% of system peak demand. And Great River Energy was formed in 1999 by 28 co-ops. Between 2006 and 2009, 8 of those co-ops became what are called partial requirements members. What they were allowed to do was cap the amount of energy they bought from GRE at the amount that they were buying at that time, and any incremental energy since 2006-2009, they were responsible for obtaining themselves outside of GRE. My understanding is they all get it from Basin Electric, another organization we talked about here. So that's just a little bit of background of where these things come from and how they operate.
We'll wait for questions unless they're pressing until after our first round of testimony. Thank you, Mr. Eloff. Greg Ragebusch, we welcome you to the committee and looking forward to hearing from you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having an opportunity this morning to speak. I'm Greg Ritterbusch, President and CEO of Kinexus Energy. Since I relocated to Minnesota in 2005, I've enjoyed serving utility members as an electric cooperative executive. Leaving out my middle years, my early career started in the Army for 10 years after graduating from West Point, and I was honored to serve. Kinexus is Minnesota's largest electric distribution cooperative, one of the largest in the country, and we serve 136,000 accounts throughout the North Metro, from east of St. Cloud to Marine on St. Croix, and as far north as Princeton. We have 1,000 square mile service area, and 12 state senators and 20 state representatives have constituents in our service area. We are 91% residential, and we're investing in modernizing our grid. Our recent initiatives have enabled us to keep rates flat for our members for 3 years running. And we earned a number one J.D. Powers ranking for customer satisfaction in 2019 among the 34 largest utilities in the upper Midwest. Our wholesale power provider is indicated by House Research, Great River Energy, and we are their largest owner. So I'd like to bring to life some of the context that has been provided already and say, how is one large utility operating? What are our views of the markets? So I'll do that in three ways. First, I'm going to comment on the origination of 20th century electric cooperative electricity very briefly. And then I'm going to comment in current times how business models and structures are changing to realize benefits from the modern electric grid. And clearly, we're in the midst of a clean energy transition, and it's very important. And then I'll close by offering some observations on current industry trends, including the power purchase contract, from the perspective of a large, highly engaged cooperative utility. So a quick historical perspective informs today. If you come to our headquarters in Ramsey, you can see the bank book where 13 farmers, $2 each for a share, formed the legal entity that was the predecessor of Kinexus today. Initially, these systems were tiny. They were very localized. The ethic of serving members started then. It was members serving members. Democratically elected boards of members regulated the business, and the resource pathway to electrifying rural areas was federally supported loans. And many co-ops like us are off federal loans today, but it was critical during that time. And electric applications grew and grew. Initially, they were really happy about lighting a light bulb. And then all of a sudden, look at all these other things we can do. So what happened? There was the need for additional generation transmission. And to realize scale economies, co-ops bound together to do that. And each G&T then formed, and it generated and moved power to its member owners, not the more complex competitive markets that we have today. They were regulated democratically, the G&Ts, by elected co-op boards, and over time, regional reliability organizations were formed to coordinate transmission and resource efficiency in the region. The long-term all-requirements contracts, as indicated by House Research very accurately, occurred then, and they were, as stated, to support G&T commitments being made for the whole, the building and operating and paying for long-term assets. So enough of the past. So we're here today, and old models are acclimating to new challenges and opportunities. For co-op electricity, some things have not changed, and these are good things. The focus and ethic of service to member owners has not changed. The utility accountability for affordability, reliability, and resiliency is really strong in our values. And our long-term member PPCs still are a mainstream practice with few changes today, although they're evolving. So, but many things have changed, and you know, at a certain degree, I'm preaching to the choir, but let me just give you a quick list. I think these are important because they benefit the consumers, and everyone in the room is a consumer, right? The creation of independent markets, in our case, MISO, to oversee regulated transmission and make a market for wholesale generation and assure resource efficiency is an important evolution. In the Midwest region, wholesale generation competes on price to deliver into MISO, and all load is served out of MISO. Many don't haven't heard that before. Really, it's a kind of a detail that's important. State RES mandates and federal renewable tax and related subsidies accelerated renewable growth very successfully. And renewable energy resources at scale today are lower cost than legacy generation, giving credence to legislative ideas like Clean Energy First. Large energy markets have attracted additional wholesale energy providers, bringing more renewables and other generation sources on stream. U.S. companies like NextEra and European companies like Electricité de France, Engie, and others. And consumer expectations, all of our expectations in this room have evolved. Greener, want more control. Let me choose how I'm going to do conservation efforts. Things like that have all changed. And electric technology has progressively become more efficient. And, of course, the challenging new threat environment that could never have been anticipated long, long ago, cybersecurity, grid, and keeping data secure. So in this new context of where we stand today, what are the strategic implications to the clean energy transition that's in progress? First, I would say expect electric industry decarbonization of legacy coal to continue its journey downward. Renewables and natural gas are the replacement. Economics are the inexorable driver of the transition. Battery prices are dropping like a rock. Solar and wind cost materially less than legacy generation. And we are buyers, and there is no doubt. Maintaining affordability with declining per capita use. The reliability and resiliency are all, I think, underappreciated by mainstream as challenges, but we're succeeding at meeting them. Distributed energy resources themselves will be located progressively across all parts of the modern grid, and significant utility-scale wind and solar and related transmission investments will all be needed for the future we're envisioning. And we all need to be open to working together across all stakeholders, something that we take to heart at Conexus. And in this context, the civility in public policy, including cross-sector considerations, are vital as we work together in this transition. So, consistent with this, what's Conexus been up to? I'm going to give you a quick laundry list. We've embraced the transition, and we share our experiences with other cooperatives. And here's some recent examples. If you like country at all, you remember the song, "It Was Country Before Country Was Cool." In 2014, we put in the first community solar array. It was a small one, but we were community solar before community solar was cool. In 2014, that array was the first one where we planted pollinator plantings. It's now standard for our arrays, and we were appreciative to Fresh Energy for their expertise in helping us look at that option. Martha Stewart, Nat Geo, and New York Times all picked up on that early array, and today it's small and everyone's doing it, and that's really good. In 2016, the first co-production of honey on a solar asset was done. Again, Rob Davis at Fresh Energy provided a lot of expertise and contacts for that, and today it's a standard. We put in solar. If beekeepers want to locate apiaries near these friendly zones, we are very happy to have them there. The first 2016 member program to go all green half house, whole house. Not everyone has a home that is situated so you can put solar on it. Apartment dwellers, apartment holders, hard to do. So we allow Conexus members today, on their request, to green their use half house or whole house. In 2016 to 18, over 3 years, was the largest single investment in recent history for Conexus. We put in advanced metering infrastructure, called AMI. We went from manually reading 130,000 reads per month to electronically taking in 13 million reads per day. And now we are using that data, keeping the data secure, and we are finding extremely innovative ways beyond my time I could share this morning with how to use that data to make the grid that much more efficient. In 2018, the first megawatt size class integrated solar and storage project went into commercial service. And we appreciated hosting recently the LEC who visited that asset. 2019, Ramsey became the headquarters of Conexus, became supplied 100% renewables. And we mean to lead by example and felt that was something that we wanted to do. In 2019, we also rolled out a conservation program that's brand new for our consumers who are tired of their air conditioning is going off whenever the utility sent signals to it. We allow them to choose how, when we signal when, to reduce their use when requested during June, July, and August. And we pay them for performance. We pay them 7 times our retail rate, $1 per kilowatt hour, when they reduce, when we can get the savings for the overall membership. So what I'd say is we're not done. Stay tuned. We have other things that are coming. So as I near the end of my remarks, let me offer a point of view on a couple topics of the many associated with clean energy transition. And maybe the first on cooperative distribution grid flexibility is related to the G&T power purchase contracts. Conexus today has flexibility up to 5% for renewable self-supply in our power purchase contract with Great River Energy. And as you have heard, this most of that list, we are using that flexibility. Haven't used it all up yet, but we're on a path to do so. In the clean energy transition underway, new opportunities to benefit consumers are significant for distribution cooperatives like Conexus and the G&Ts. More distributed renewables, envisioning community battery storage applications and solutions. Batteries as alternatives to distribution wholesale power infrastructure are all out there as opportunities. And, of course, I don't mean to segment out the investor-owned municipals. It's opportunities for them, too. While those things could never have been complicated by could have been contemplated by legacy G&T contracts, just think of the changes we have all experienced in the last 5 years. I submit our 20th century predecessors who formed those contracts could never have anticipated today's opportunities, technologies, and economies. So our PPC runs through 2045. It is all requirements. So any change in terms of more flexibility and other things is a negotiated outcome among the cooperative membership and subject to approval by all of GRE's members. In multiple states, similar issues and opportunities have surfaced, and cooperative systems with various needs are working out solutions. I think that our common DNA is a vital imperative to benefit member consumers, and from that, things will get worked out as we continue to evolve. Second thing I'd like to comment on briefly is resource siting. And just think about all the renewables that are coming our way by 2050 as we envision and act on this clean energy transition. I would assert that more public effort is needed to define and enable stakeholder-sensitive siting of renewable and transmission network growth. NIMBY is already emerging. We're in such a green state, but, you know, I can understand it. Continuing collaborative conversation and legislation may become needed. Valuable public and private lands can be impacted. And thus far, Conexus has been successful with careful hard work with stakeholders, including agricultural co-production, we think is worthy of consideration as we bring these things into areas that consumers see. And also, initiatives like what was started last year by the legislature, like Brightfields, where we're looking at using mostly uneconomic land, like skirt zones around capped or closed landfills. We have one right next to us at Ramsey we tried to use, but were unable to because of simple administration. And so it is a great idea that was started, and we are participating in that analysis today with the Brightfields committee. So the last thing I'd like to talk about is conservation or energy optimization. The state SIP program, progressive in its time and successful, it's time to be reformed. The hallmark of the legacy program, which is conventional conservation, must continue. But with an ever cleaner, greener grid, thoughtful provisions need to be considered to supplement existing program options to foster efficient uses of electricity. One example that illustrate the point is electric vehicles. Kinexis envisions helping consumers with rebates for in-house charging. We've had an EV rate for already a good number of years now. We envision helping commercial, institutional, including schools, with fleet charging solutions. Electrification of transportation hits, my loose term, the trifecta. It saves energy. It lowers consumers' costs, and it lowers societal net carbon. So today, providing rebates to foster EV utilization is outside the domain of legacy SIP. In an era where we should be thinking cross-sector in our energy transition, the legacy SIP program is mostly about reducing electricity, not as more broadly saving energy in all its forms. So cooperative boards and management are aligned to manage costs and optimize benefits of all consumer programs, including SIP. Our board looks over these. Traditional conservation is going to continue. It's the right thing for the consumer. But let's add new, efficient, cost-saving, lower carbon uses of electricity. And as a side note, that increasing use will also help moderate future rates as the economy and the utilization of energy shifts. Finally, a mention about state SIP administration. Differentiate it between investor and customer-owned utilities. Given the accountability of cooperative boards as our regulator, we view existing DOC administrative oversight and reporting requirements as acceptable. What we have is working. But with overall smaller scale and no IOU-like incentive awards to look through, we believe that adding more administration to what is working today would only add cost and dampen the innovation that I think many are expecting to see from cooperatives as we go forward. So I believe Minnesota, with respect to SIP, has the opportunity to build upon what has been its successful history and reform the program for the next decades of clean energy transition. And you can expect cooperative innovation and continuing commitment from Kinexis along those lines. So Madam Chair and members of the committee, it has been a real honor to speak today. Thank you for letting me share a few thoughts on what is exciting to us as the energy markets continue their clean transition and for us to be a part of that transition helping here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I had said at the beginning we would hold questions till the end, but I do understand that Mr. Reiterbusch has to leave earlier, and so I'm going to welcome questions now. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you so much for your presentation, and I appreciate your leadership in greening the grid and the things that you are doing with Kinexis. And I was one of the people who joined with the LEC tour that came out to look at your facility, and we saw your community solar garden as well as the storage facility. And it seems to me you were only able to use the storage, the battery storage, a small amount of time. Can you help me remember what that was?
Yes, so battery storage, and I'll make this quick because it could be long.
Okay.
The battery storage has many ways it can be used. Let me call them use cases. And in those use cases, you look to apply a battery, invest in it, in a kind of use that creates economic benefit to pay for the battery itself. No one's going to give anyone a battery for free just to try out. So the use case for the array in Ramsey is one of peak shaving, which allows us during a high cost hour or a couple hours each month to take solar energy that we acquired at a certain price and shift it in time and then use it during the times on the grid that the costs are higher. It's very much the same, but with current technology, as any kind of peak shaving thing, you turn off an AC system, it's kind of the same thing. But in this case, we're doing it at scale, and we're doing it where it doesn't inconvenience a whole bunch of consumers, at least for the 15 megawatts that we use. So that was the business case for that one. We are investigating and been part of a group of utilities at, across the nation thinking about battery storage use cases. And in fact, we're evaluating behind-the-meter ones today, trying to help consumers look at them. So that's the short story. We shift energy to when it's worth more, and then that value stream is enough to pay for the batteries, and that's its use case.
And so maybe if I can just follow up, Madam Chair, could I then also assume that you could use it more to prevent in other ways to potentially save money for your ratepayers?
Whenever you put in batteries, there are other applications. So let's just hope it never happens. We have some event that causes the northwest grid to go dark, some assets shut down, what have you. Those batteries being in a state of charge allow a certain period of time where we can backfeed the grid from solutions like batteries. So we are looking at that. We have consumers today that use diesel engine gensets to do that kind of thing. Battery prices will eventually get to the point where it can be used to supplement the grid. So that is something that can be done with our batteries, but it happens so infrequently, good thing, right? Mm-hmm. And that we could not depend on anything like that to make a business case for installing those batteries.
And so you're saying that just the couple hours a month that you're using them now is better than even using them on a regular basis to generate or to store energy when it's cheaper to use when it's more expensive?
Yeah, in the rate structures that exist today, that is the case. If rate structures change, then the thing that's great about battery solutions is they're ultimately flexible. And the other thing I'd tell you about the one that we have done is it's one of something that can be tasked over 2 to 4 hours. Ultimately, over time, there will be ones that can be tasked for longer periods of time. So batteries still are quite an emerging use, and the economics are emerging too. So it's part of the stay tuned part. We're excited by what can be done with these technologies.
And so you said, I'm sorry, just one more quick follow-up. So you said it's part of the rate structure that has you using it in that application, and is that part of the power purchase contract, and is that something that can be negotiated to be looked at differently in the future?
Well, you're getting into some very detailed things, but all power purchase contracts and their rate structures are things that are negotiated among parties, so yes. Okay. And then the actual cost and on the grid itself also has a lot to do with the evolution of pricing within MISO. I think the committee probably knows that MISO pricing has really dropped significantly with additional renewables on the grid. And so, yeah, these things are evolving, and beyond that, without getting really detailed, it's hard to go much further.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for your leadership, Mr. Ritterbusch, and vision and bringing the Minnesota, the largest solar and battery storage, I think, still in the country. Is that right? We had a great time coming out to visit it with the Legislative Energy Commission. So you previewed some of the plans that you had and said stay tuned, and perhaps you can't share, but I'm curious what opportunities you're looking to in the future in the renewable energy space, and what are some of the challenges that you see to achieving those opportunities?
Well, one I will share, thank you, Representative, for the question. One I'll share straight out is we've yet to install what are called single axis trackers, and so this year we're going to add another 100 acres that will be a single axis tracker. I call them sunflowers. You know, they wake up in the morning, they point at the sun, they point at the sun during the day, and they point at the end of the day. And what's exciting about that, and in this case it wouldn't be the first in Minnesota, but in Minnesota the capacity factors, the amount of time that solar assets actually are performing are somewhere between 14 to 15% of the year. These things add a couple more percent, so it makes the economics of installing solar that much stronger. So we are putting that in this year, and it will be up in the North Metro. We've also been conceptualizing and trying to figure out when battery pricing gets to the point that institutional consumers schools, community colleges, things like that, might look at their existing backup systems like, you know, diesel gen sets and things that maybe been there for 30 years or more and say, time to replace or modernize, trying to anticipate when the economics of batteries could allow those systems to be, if they had local renewables there, so can renewables and then provide for their own backup. And so we're working with consumers, and there's several discussions around that have expressed interest, but you can't make it work with current economics, but they're getting closer. So that's a little bit of what we're looking at.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your testimony and your presence here. You had mentioned the rebates for in-house charging, and I really appreciated your talking about transportation as it relates to climate change and energy. Are there other incentives that you have for electrification of the transportation infrastructure, and would you have any advice for the legislature on how to provide some maybe new or innovative, incentives to promote this technology?
So the primary ones today, and I set aside the acquisition of vehicles themselves because I think it's beyond what a utility would count on or comment on whether you subsidize or what. I set that aside. I think about when a consumer wants to go from a fossil fuel vehicle to electric, a big consideration is, well, how am I going to charge this thing, and I'm going to run out of batteries on while I'm out using it, and what happens in the wintertime. So what we have had a time of use rate that can be separately metered for a long time. But one thing that that we are trying this year is we're trying to work with our local builders. Now I don't literally mean this in as it's going to sound, but I ask myself rhetorically, why should we ever build housing stock anymore if we believe electric vehicles are a solution and we want to provide it available and make it easy for the consumer? Why should housing stock be put in service without 220 outlets or 220 outlets in shared apartment complexes and things like that? So we're trying to work with our local builders, not to tell them that they have to do it, but to share with them the opportunities that we see and to offer rebates to them to at least pull the circuit for a 220 into a garage or wherever the vehicle storage location is in a given home. So we're doing things like that, and we're doing it in a collaborative way. So you can have a program, put it on your website, and say, we'll provide a rebate. That's not enough. You should get out there and work with the builders that are trying to do these things, and it provides them another feature in a home that might be attractive to modern consumers. So we're looking at that kind of thing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really like that idea. You know, I did a bill actually that would have mandated or required it, and that didn't go very far. But how successful have you been with the builders with that particular incentive?
It's very new, so I wouldn't even couch it as success. It's something where we have a person on staff that has the accountability for relationship development with builders, so it's key accounts. And so we meet with builders once a year before their construction season really gets heavy. We use those meetings to bring new technologies like air source heat pumps and other conservation items. So it is new. So it's too soon to tell. But I think they're also driven, as we all are, we're consumers, right? So I think consumer pull from the other side. And from a builder standpoint, witnessing the attractiveness of their home being better with these kind of capabilities, Wi-Fi thermostats and other things in the home is kind of part of what we're trying to be a resource to our builders for.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to have one more question. Representative Ball.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of quick questions. I was not able to attend the tour that day because I had events in my district, but can you tell me a little more about the battery usage? Do you charge them and then discharge them each day, or do they sit charged for a great period of time, or how often are they cycled?
It's very interesting. So batteries in that use case like to stay at about 50% constant charge level until you're ready to use them, fill them up to the top, and then discharge. So the way, and I'll be short, and I'll let any further questions drive me more detail. That asset we have as a contract for service from NextEra. That's not a secret. That's public domain. And NextEra actually controls the batteries, their charge state, and taking energy on and discharge from Florida. And then we have visibility from our network center here up in Ramsey. So they like to cruise at 50%. When you're ready to use them, you task them for charging during the early morning hours because the high cost hours are usually late in the day, and then you discharge them on a profile. And you can, it's not all at once. You can say, I want so much this hour, so much the next hour. It just depends upon your forecast of need. So it ends up getting kind of wonky and technical, but we have a team that in every single month their use is different.
Thank you. And I'm trying to wrap my head around, you know, peak versus off-peak. Yeah. What sort of percent usage is there on when we're at peak versus off-peak? Is there quite a difference between those two, or are they?
There is a lot of difference. And in the economics of electric generation over the long haul, you never want to build an asset that is designed to operate most of the time for peak hours because you end up not using it during the rest of the hours of the year. So you end up putting in peaking assets like natural gas equipment, natural gas peakers. On the long haul, as an example, natural gas peakers in any given market might operate 3 to 5% of a year. So that's generally the hours that you'd expect to see electricity at a higher cost. So that's roughly what you'd see. And then in a energy utilization rate, we get exposed to pricing is going to be this during this hour. So then we attempt to hit the hour and then benefit the consumer by using stored solar energy.
One last question, I promise. This will be it. As we start to see more EVs coming on and more promotion of EVs, what impact does that have as far as the ability to utilize off-peak as off-peak usage grows?
We see a great opportunity for that. Off-peak pricing in MISO is quite soft because why? We're all asleep and not using our ovens and dishwashers and all that. So the opportunity for charging off-peak is a really good one. And so we know for the homes that we have EVs on how their utilization runs, and we can see the differences in use between off-peak and ones that would charge at other times. So the energy, not just the industry, not just Conexus, is looking at how do you provide a benefit through pricing signals, rates, to consumers to charge when it's most beneficial to them. Of course, the utility is never going to tell anyone you can't charge whenever you want. It just should make sure that the pricing signal recovers the costs associated with that use.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming and sharing your forward thinking. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have a good committee meeting.
Thank you. Next is Dan Jewell, and while he's coming up, I will just tell members there was an article in the Strib that talked about a project he was doing, a very small project, but it was the pricing issue that caught my attention. And since the price of electricity to consumers should always catch our attention. So with that, I'm hoping we'll talk a little bit about pricing, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Jewell. And I'm with Jewell Energy. I'm the chairman of the board. I'm formerly the CEO, but I'm supposed to be retired, but I'm not sure how that really works. And so I was asked to come here today to talk about what we're doing with the distributed hybrid technology that we helped GE develop as part of a problem that we saw in delivering sustainable energy to our communities. Our company has been involved in community-based development for many, many years. I think we built the first wind project for our friends at Northern States Power in 1986 on the Buffalo Ridge. And since then, we've built 35 projects and mostly concentrate on distributed energy and community-based projects. So I always thought that pictures are worth 1,000 words in this discussion. And when we talk about what we're talking about on this project that I think the chairwoman referred to was the one at Lake Region Electric Co-op, where we built a solar wind hybrid for a co-op in Pelican Rapids. But this graph basically shows you where those, how, why we call it mid-grid. As you can see at the top left, there's the power plants we all know and love that require fuel in and water in, and then all kinds of things come out of it. And then we have a step-up transformer to high voltage, 345,000 volts. That goes hundreds of miles to another substation that kicks it down to 115,000 volts, which goes many, many more miles and kicks it down to 69,000 volts. And then down at the bottom, it goes to a local substation, which kicks it down to 25 kV or 12.5 kV. And then it comes to us, the consumers. And so you can see there's a large path to get there. And in our efforts in our business, we saw that transmission and permitting was a big issue in developing renewable energy. It wasn't in the past, but it is now. It's a very big problem. And so that's why we worked to develop the hybrid technology to be able to plug into the system commercial scale energy and garner economies of scale and deliver that power right close to where it's being consumed. And the obvious reason for that is that the transmission costs are a fair part of our energy costs, plus reliability is an issue. And so and then you can see in the graph where the community-based hybrid plugs in right about at the local substation. In fact, the Lake Region project that we're talking about that's online plugs in on the barn side of that substation. It's on the actual, on the load side of that substation. And that's because that's where Lake Region wanted it. They wanted it on that side because of their situation with Great River Energy. So, and on these community projects like this, we look at storage on them. We've got projects working in Kansas, Wisconsin, all over. And we look at storage, and when we look at storage with a community-based project, putting it on the grid is a good thing. You can use it as an arbitrage, as a previous speaker talked about, where you can store energy and deliver it during peak times. But when we do the community projects, we look at putting storage strategically into the system at the load. But it's controlled by the system that controls the power, the solar hybrids. And so basically what that means is that during peak times, you can take a business or home off grid and they won't even know it, because the storage provides load directly to them. You're not trying to satisfy the whole substation system. And when we look at the community, we look at the courthouse and the hospital and the convenience store and the grocery store, things that people really need when the grid goes down. And so it works a double duty as, A, a capacity component in the delivery of the energy, and, B, a reliability for the community itself, which has got a huge value to a lot of communities where we live. This is just a typical layout of a hybrid project. This one is actually the one we were working on up in Red Lake Falls. And it's, you can see the two turbines up on the top, and they go down. The solar fields are down by where the point of interconnect is. The white spot is the actual substation that ties in into the sub-transmission line of the utility at that point. And so both the wind and the solar dump power into the grid right there, and that's actually about a half a mile from the city of Red Lake Falls. And so it provides energy and capacity. And that was the idea with the hybrid, the solar wind hybrid, is that the wind provides power during the winter peaks, the sun provides power during the summer peaks, and it creates a very valuable asset for the producing power. And then if you add a little bit of storage, you really complement the whole thing. But this is just a typical layout. And then, let's see, I have some numbers. Here we go. You see, this site is an average site in Minnesota. I mean, this is not a super hot site. This is not the top of the Buffalo Ridge. And you can see that these turbines produce 2.2 million kilowatt hours a year. That's a lot of power. And then the solar, 1.3 megawatts of solar, produces 1.6 gigawatts of power. And so the total is 23 million kilowatt hours. If we're going to try to do that same amount of kilowatt hour production with just solar alone, it would take over 110 acres, probably 120 acres of land to do that. This project consumes 7 acres of land. The solar and the wind combined consume 7 acres of land to produce 23 million kilowatt hours a year. And that's a real value to us as we're trying to look at how we use have land use, especially out in farming areas. And if we need power, this seems to be for us a way to do it. And when you look at the economics of this, I come at this from as a consumer. I'm a member of the Red Lake Electric Co-op, which is part of the Minn Kota system. And I get our annual report. And our annual report says that we pay Minn Kota Power 7.8 cents per kilowatt hour for them to deliver power to my substation right outside of my where I live, to my co-op. And then we look at this hybrid, which basically plugs into that same substation, and we can deliver power for 4.5 cents to the same substation, the same energy. And when I look at that from a consumer standpoint, that 3.3 cent difference is about $780,000 a year that my co-op would save by using sustainable clean energy delivered right to the load. And so that's a real economic value, and that's what we really need to look at. What is the real value? How do we put these economics into Minnesota? We import so much energy. And if we can develop these resources and deliver economically clean power right to the load, that's a real value. And then strategically place storage inside of that, that increases the value dramatically for resiliency, especially where we live out in the rural areas. So that, to me, that's the real economic. I know Gene, Representative Wagenius, asked me to talk a little bit about the economics, and to me that's the best way to tell the economics, is that's a real live story. I mean, that's the reality of the economics of today. And this is just a little summary that basically talks about it. And the bottom line in this summary is the real bottom line. It's that we can produce low-cost, clean, sustainable energy with no fuel, no emissions, no waste, no water, and no transmission costs. Those are the five things that drive our energy costs right up. And so if we can do that and create jobs in the interim and keep our energy dollars local, it's a win-win-win situation. So thank you.
Thank you so much. We're going to hold questions now. If you're allowed, you can stay for what, just a bit.
Okay.
No problem. And we're going to now have Dr. Gabe Chin, assistant professor of the University of Minnesota, chat with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak today about electric cooperatives in Minnesota. My name is Gabriel Chan. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs, where I also chair our area on science, technology, and environmental policy. I'm here today in my own capacity as a researcher and private citizen, not a representative of the University of Minnesota. So this morning, I'd like to offer some insights about electric cooperatives in Minnesota based on a 3-year research project that I conducted with Dr. Stephanie Lenhart, Professor Elizabeth Wilson, and two of my former students, Matthew Grimley and Lindsay Forsberg. Electric cooperatives in Minnesota are not-for-profit utilities. As we heard very nicely in the discussion this morning, they're owned by the customers they serve. In fact, they're called member owners. There are 45 electric cooperatives that serve customers in Minnesota, 44 solely based in the state. And Minnesota has the second highest number of electric cooperatives of any state. This creates a very important context as we think about the diversity across these utilities. Electric cooperatives serve about 30% of customers in Minnesota, and they sell about 22% of all electricity in the state. To understand the full context, Minnesota has 3 investor-owned utilities that are about 54% of customers and 124 municipal utilities that serve 14% of customers. Much of what I will say today also applies to the structure of municipal utilities, more or less, but there's significant differences with the investor-owned utilities. The first point I'd like to make is that Minnesota's electric cooperatives are very diverse, and it's really hard, basically impossible, to generalize about all 45 of them. Some cooperatives are seeing growth in the amount of electricity they sell. Others are seeing decline. Some are seeing rapid increases in the number of member owners they serve and the revenue they collect. Some are seeing more incremental growth. Some are even seeing decline. And very importantly for utilities, as we talked about a lot in the context of batteries and renewables, the peak demand, meaning the most amount of electricity that a utility serves at a point in time over the year, is growing in some cooperatives and declining in others. And then in addition to this operational diversity, there's very different situational contexts. Cooperatives serve the vast majority of the land area of the state, and they're also in very different power supplier networks. As Bob Eliff described at the beginning, the power supply networks are really central to how we think about cooperatives, and this is a core theme of what I want to talk about today. So many of the electric cooperatives in Minnesota were created around the New Deal era as part of the Rural Electrification Act. Electric cooperatives were created to serve parts of the country that for-profit investor-owned utilities were not able to profitably serve. Instead, with large federal support, consumer-owned, locally controlled rural electric cooperatives were established. These utilities were much smaller than investor-owned utilities and adopted very different principles as they operated. Some of those principles include concern for community and democratic member control. This really helped them stay grounded in the context in which they were created. In the decades that followed the New Deal, the electricity system really started to change. There have been advances in electric power generating technologies, particularly the development of large power plants, particularly coal, that became the cheapest way to generate power. The economies of scale with large power plants made it such that the most economic way to generate power was to go larger and larger. And so for small electric cooperatives, the only way to take advantage of these changing economics was to band together and co-invest in large power plants. So to do this, electric cooperatives formed generation and transmission cooperatives, or GNTs. GNTs you can think of as a kind of cooperative of cooperatives. They're controlled by the member cooperatives that own the distribution lines, and these GNTs own power plants and transmission lines in the so-called family of member cooperatives. So the structure of GNTs were a solid economic decision at the time. They allowed cooperatives to procure cheaper power, and also to share some of the large fixed costs associated with building the technical capacity to build out the grid. Moving forward in time, GNTs allowed cooperatives to nimbly participate in new institutions like restructured wholesale electricity markets. As we mentioned, MISO is the region that Minnesota's in. That participation is mostly done by the GNTs. Also allowed cooperatives to take advantage of other smart technologies like controllable thermostats. Cooperatives were some of the earliest adopters of what's called demand response technology that allows the actual utility to control when, for example, the water heater turns on. And so this structure has really served cooperatives very well, particularly smaller cooperatives. The next point I want to turn to is the power supply contracts. So foundational to this GNT model was the establishment of contracts, power supply contracts. Because GNTs were primarily predicated on creating the ability for small distribution cooperatives to co-invest in large power plants, the relationships between the distribution cooperatives with their generation and transmission partners was formalized through power supply contracts. So to get a general sense, GNT members might have chosen to co-invest in a coal power plant with an expected lifetime of, let's say, 50 years. The debt on that power plant would also be tied to the expected lifetime of the plant. And therefore, to make the GNT financially viable, distribution cooperatives would be asked to sign power supply contracts that would guarantee that power plant would have a reliable base of customers over that similar 50-year lifespan. So these power supply contracts formalized the relationship between the distribution cooperatives and the GNTs and allowed for the financeability of large power plants. So now moving forward in time to much more recently. In the last 10 to 20 years, the energy system is undergoing profound changes. Two very important changes, particular to electric cooperatives, have been the rapidly declining cost of renewables, other distributed energy technologies like storage, as we heard about, and also natural gas. Also very importantly, the changing reliance on federal finance that initially supported the co-ops is also changing. And as we heard Mr. Ritterbusch explain, also there's been some really important changes with the establishment of wholesale markets, environmental regulation, customer engagement, cybersecurity, and these have all had really profound changes on cooperatives. So on the cost side, natural gas and renewables have economics that are very different than these coal plants that really rationalize the GNT model. They have different economies of scale. Renewables basically hit economies of scale at 1 to 5 megawatts. Natural gas is very different variable cost. The variable costs really dominate a natural gas power plant. And so the economics are really changing, and this has put a lot of pressure on power supply contracts. So what I want to turn to next is how are those pressures materializing and how are cooperatives responding? So this changing landscape of power supply contracts and the pressures on them is really critical for thinking about what's going to happen next. Minnesota's 45 electric cooperatives are responding to this pressure differently. Just as there is really different diversity in the co-ops, how they're responding to these pressures is also really different. And Minnesota's not unique in this regard. There are over 900 electric cooperatives in the country, and they're facing these pressures too. So I would characterize the response to the pressures of changing economics and structures on a spectrum, where the spectrum on one end is unilateral action, and on the other end is collective action. So on the far end of unilateral action, there are some electric cooperatives, such as in Colorado, that are working to break away from their generation transmission partner. They're breaking away these contracts by buying them out and then choosing to procure their own power from a private company. A less extreme version on that end of the spectrum of unilateral action has been the renegotiation of the so-called self-supply limits in those contracts. So as we heard about, there are these all-requirement contracts, but these are starting to be renegotiated, allowing distribution utilities to build some of their own power supply. For example, many distribution cooperatives in the G&T Great River Energy are allowed to self-supply up to 5% of generation, such as with small wind or solar. But we're seeing examples in Minnesota where distribution utilities are looking for ways to do even more. On the other end of the spectrum, collective action. On the far end of what's going on in response to pressures on the collective action side has been a redoubling of these power supply contracts. We have examples in Minnesota where G&Ts are asking their distribution members to sign contracts that go through the year 2075, really strengthening that relationship, ensuring that the distribution cooperatives will be there with their G&T partners for another more than 50 years. A less extreme example on that end of the spectrum of collective action have been distribution cooperatives working closely with their G&Ts to build new renewable projects together and co-investing in these more distributed projects. So across this spectrum of unilateral action to collective action, I want to emphasize that the energy transition is happening on both sides, that decarbonization, reducing emissions, is possible with both unilateral action and collective action. Change can happen when cooperatives work alone in their sole interest, and change can happen when they work together in their collective interest in the family. Electric cooperatives have, in their established principles, these two principles, concern for community and cooperation amongst cooperatives. And we're seeing that some of these pressures are leading to a redoubling towards concern for individual communities and working together cooperation amongst cooperatives. In some cases, unilateral action may actually harm the other distribution cooperatives in the G&T family. There's a possible for cost shifts when a distribution co-op takes action in their own interests. But at the same time, collective action can lock distribution cooperatives and limit their ability to serve their communities as effectively as they would like. And so this is an important tension, that there are potential benefits and concerns with unilateral action and collective action, and this won't be easily resolved. And importantly also, some small cooperatives just simply do not have the capacity to act unilaterally and are very well served by staying in their G&T family. And so to conclude, I think it's very important to keep in mind that electric cooperatives in Minnesota are facing very different circumstances. And as the systems change and new pressures are applied, such as dealing with the very important challenge of climate change, policy will need to carefully take into account the diversity of cooperatives and allow for many different pathways of change. So this may require more of a scalpel approach than a broad brush approach with respect to local control, listening to the perspective of cooperatives across the state as they grapple with this really dynamic, changing environment. It's also important to keep in mind that while at the same time it's very important to honor the agreements of the past that made sense then, it's also important to be able to change and take advantage of the new opportunities of today. And so we believe that there's a lot to be learned from talking with local practitioners and working together towards common goals. And thank you for listening. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that. I think, members, we will take questions for Mr. Jewell or Dr. Chan. Representative Swisenski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just kind of a question to you. So essentially kind of what you were talking a little bit about was essentially taking two companies that are privately owned and having the state step in between a private contract. So let's say Conexus Energy or GRE would have some sort of a contract in place. You're saying the state should maybe step in and and sever a private contract?
Oh, no, this was not the state doing this. The example I gave was in Colorado, where actually the distribution utility chose to buy out their contract. So it was without state. So there's some state oversight, but they negotiated that.
Senator Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The power supply contracts that you're discussing for, you know, 50 years or longer, are these generally for, you know, for example, if they were created to cooperatively build a coal plant or something along those lines, are the contracts generally for delivery of power from a particular energy source or plant, or are they delivery for a particular power amount?
So thank you for your question. The financial rationalization may be tied to a power plant, but that's not part of the contract. The contract is for all sources. So they're not specifically tied to a particular power plant, although the reasons why they are different lengths and have different terms, obviously it's based on assets underlying it, but there's also a lot of financial workings behind that, and they're not directly tied to resources. So resources can change behind the contracts. Those contracts would still stand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if the G&T changed the energy mix on their end, then that wouldn't necessarily require any renegotiation of some of these long-term contracts if, you know, they were moving away from a power source that might have been the original concept for the long-term contract. That wouldn't necessarily require renegotiation.
So that's generally true. Those are true for all requirements contracts. There are some so-called fixed contracts, which are tied to specific retirements. And so, you know, the theme of my presentation was that there's a lot of diversity. This is generally true, but not always 100% true.
Thank you. That's helpful. And for the self-supply limits, you mentioned, Mr. Ritterbush mentioned 5%. Is that a pretty typical amount that you're seeing across the state? And you mentioned some folks were negotiating higher amounts. I'm curious
We have a figure that describes a lot of these self-supply requirements. It's in our full report, which I'm happy to provide a copy of. Great River Energy has a 5% self-supply for all of its all requirements members. And so that's not the majority of cooperatives in the state, and it really differs by which G&T family you're in. And those can take different forms. Some are percents, some are fixed capacity. Some are fixed capacity for the whole G&T family, and whoever gets there first gets to self-supply. And, you know, it varies.
I don't see additional questions. I suspect we're going to have some later, however. So I appreciate your coming and beginning this education for us. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Thank you all so much. One of the things that there was some miscommunication, I think. I had told the folks at Great River Energy that we were going to have this hearing, and they thought they were going to be testifying. So we're going to take a small break and ask Eric Olson to come up. He said he wanted to speak for a few minutes, and then we will go to the second half of our hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for squeezing me in unscheduled like this. I appreciate it, and hello, members of the committee. My name is Eric Olson, and I am the Vice President and General Counsel of Great River Energy, who you've heard about already today. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify regarding our member owners' wholesale power supply contracts with GRE. You've heard about G&T cooperatives. Great River Energy is a generation and transmission electric cooperative owned by 28 electric distribution cooperatives across Minnesota. GRE's sole purpose is to provide wholesale electric supply on a not-for-profit basis to our member owners, who collectively serve about 1.7 Minnesotans. Like generation and transmission co-ops all across the country, GRE was formed by electric distribution cooperatives who wanted to control their destiny by providing their own power supply. Our member owners made the member contract central to their G&T business model by granting GRE the exclusive right to provide power supply in their service territories and obligating themselves to pay all of GRE's costs. In that way, GRE's banded together by forming GRE and bound themselves together and to GRE with their member contracts. GRE has no right to serve anyone. We have no service territory other than what rights our members grant us through their contracts with us. The contracts also serve as our regulatory compact with our members. Vertically integrated utilities are rate and resource regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. Our member owners regulate GRE's rates and generating resources, and the manner in which that is done is set forth in our member contracts. In addition, our members govern us. In accordance with GRE's Articles of Incorporation and Bylaws, GRE's Board of Directors consists solely of members of the boards of directors of our member owner cooperatives. And through GRE's Articles and Bylaws, our members make collective decisions regarding GRE, including retaining the ultimate authority to dissolve GRE and to approve withdrawal from GRE by any member owner of GRE. The centrality of the member contracts to G&Ts is recognized by our stakeholders. The contracts serve as the most important security for our indebtedness, and our bondholders and ratings agencies recognize that our primary source of paying our debts is the rates paid by our members through their contracts. You heard about government funding of electric cooperatives. Great River Energy bought out of its RUS government funding in 2007, and for the last 13 years, we have secured all our funding in the capital markets outside of the government. In order to ensure that GRE can borrow money and pay our debts for the long-term lives of the generating resources and other assets GRE uses to serve our members, our member owners agreed among themselves that their contracts with their G&T needed to be long-term. GRE has two basic contracts. The first is a transmission service contract, and the second is a power purchase contract. The transmission contract is the same for all 28 of our members and calls for GRE to provide to each member and for each member to take from GRE transmission service for all of their load. That transmission service contract runs through the year 2050. We currently have three types of member power purchase contracts, which we call PPCs. All of those expire at the end of 2045. You heard earlier that some have extended contracts to 2075. That's not our members. Our member contract expires at the end of 2045. Our original PPC dates back to GRE's founding in 1999, and it included a member option to fix purchases from GRE and obtain power supply for growth elsewhere. About a decade ago, eight of our 28 members elected to fix their GRE purchases, and GRE has been supplying them with their fixed purchase requirements ever since. Also, a little over a decade ago, our other 20 members elected to replace their PPC with a new PPC that eliminated their option to fix. Pursuant to that contract, which we call our all requirements PPC, those 20 members bound themselves to purchase from GRE all power and energy required to satisfy all of their electricity sales, subject to a 5% self-serve renewable option and other limited exceptions. The reason GRE's all requirements members chose to bind themselves to GRE in this way is to provide efficiencies of scale and to share risks and benefits by having a pool of shared generating resources that include owned power plants and contracts for purchases from power plants, wind farms, and the like. GRE's pool of resources is constantly evolving, and that evolution is the product of a process of continuous evaluation of our generation portfolio and collaboration among the GRE board, our members, and GRE management. That collaborative process has led to GRE retiring a coal plant and a refuse-derived fuel plant, and to GRE exiting two contracts for the purchase of output from coal plants. As we have exited those resources, our all requirements members, through a process set forth in their GRE contract, have voted to approve other resources, including hundreds of megawatts of wind farm output and additionally solar projects. And at the same time, as you heard from Mr. Ritterbusch, our members have been innovating themselves and using their 5% self-supply renewable option for wind, solar paired with storage and the like. The touchstone for evaluating our resource portfolio is GRE's triple bottom line of affordable rates, reliable service, and environmental stewardship. That is why the decisions GRE and our members have made have not only reduced our CO2 emissions by 38% since 2005, but have also reduced our members' wholesale power costs from what they would have been with the other portfolio, allowing GRE to keep our rates flat for a number of years and well below the average wholesale power costs in the region. We have also maintained reliability by meeting with this portfolio the resource adequacy requirements in the MISO markets. The third contract that we have is a brand new contract that we recently worked on with two of our members and that they adopted at the beginning of 2019. Those two cooperatives wanted to keep a certain amount of load with GRE but wanted more control over the generating resources GRE uses to supply them. So we proposed a unique power contract that creates a collaborative process by which the member asks for and the member and GRE work together to procure specific physical and contractual power supply resources for the member which that member pays for but GRE owns. We call these new member-directed, these new contracts MDR or member-directed resource contracts. That new contract is being discussed by other cooperatives across the country. We've actually offered it to our, or something similar to all of our all requirements members, but to date they've chosen to remain in their all requirements PPC because of the benefits of scale and the shared pool of resources. GRE was organized and our member contracts were designed by our member owners for our member owners. GRE is open to all sorts of different configurations of the contract, and it's our job at GRE to continually innovate to help our members reach the future that they envision. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't see any questions, so we will go on to our next, and that is the Xcel Integrated Resource Plan. Representative Long, do you want to introduce the topic?
Sure. Xcel was kind enough to offer to come and present on their integrated resource plan. I think this will be helpful for members. We are create the laws that govern the Public Utilities Commission's review of integrated resource plans, and thought it would be useful since this is a going to be a big topic at the Public Utilities Commission for the year to hear from Xcel on what they are proposing in their plan to the Public Utilities Commission.
Madam Chair, representatives, I'm Bria Shea with Xcel Energy. I'm here with my colleague, PJ Martin, and thanks for having us today. We're here to talk about Xcel Energy's integrated resource plan. A quick rundown of what we're going to talk about today. First, I'm going to cover the What is an integrated resource plan? What is the purpose? What's the process we go through? And what are some of the priorities we're trying to balance as we do so? I'll also talk to you about the stakeholder engagement to date, the regulatory process we're in the middle of, and then I will turn it over to PJ, who will talk to you about the generation options, the economics associated with those options, and actually walk through the preferred plan that we submitted to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission last July. So first, what is the integrated resource plan? So it's really our 15-year view and our forecast of what our customer needs are going to be over that time frame, along with the resources that we're going to use to serve those customer needs in a least cost manner. So if you look at this chart here, you can see the black line here. That's essentially our customer needs, in addition to a reserve requirement we've got due to being a member of MISO. But essentially, it's our customer needs there. So that's the need we're trying to meet. The orange existing generation portfolio is the actual resources we've got on our system today that we are meeting our customer needs with. So this would be our wind and solar resources, nuclear units, gas, our demand-side management efforts like energy efficiency and demand response. And this includes both company-owned that Xcel Energy owns, but also our purchase power agreements that we contract with other partners for their output to meet our customer needs. So as you can see, when you get to the mid-20s, we've got enough resources and we're all set. But when you look out into the longer term over this 15-year horizon, you can see that a new resource need arises during this planning time frame. And that's really driven by a few things. I would say first and foremost, the transition and the economics of renewables, which is in part driving our proposal to retire all of our coal by 2030. So certainly the coal retirement has a big creates part of that resource need. In addition, we also have quite a few of our units, or not quite a few, but several of our resources that are just reaching the end of their useful life. We've had them on our system for, in some cases, 40 or 50 years. Doesn't make sense to make additional capital investments, so we're going to roll those off. That contributes to that resource need as well. And then finally, we've got some of those purchase power agreements with other partners that those contracts are coming to an end. So to the extent we don't renegotiate or extend those also would create that or add to those resource need. So when you think about the transition to renewables and the major changes, the planning needs to necessarily evolve as well. So traditionally, we've planned our system to meet our peak needs, which is generally on those hot summer days in the middle of summer. However, when you think about the attributes of renewables and wind and solar, and they're, you know, the wind isn't always blowing, the sun isn't always shining, compared to the dispatchable resources that we've generally used in planning our system. You can think about the load and resource challenges you've got balancing those on an hourly basis rather than that peak day basis. So it's really shifting our look to need to be sure that every hour of every day we're able to meet our customer needs. So if you look at this chart, it's just really meant to give an example of the fact that when on a system that is relying almost exclusively on variable resources like wind and solar and storage, the reliability events, so if you're looking at the 9 days here and you're on and there's a nuclear outage in this example, so that is out of the equation, and you got low renewable production on the middle about day two, the storage can only get you through those first couple days, and then by day four, we've got loss of load because the storage duration wasn't able to carry it through. So again, it's just really shifting our planning, and we believe we can do this, and we are, but it's just really shifting that view of the peak versus the 8,760 hours a day to make sure we're meeting our customer needs, or a year, sorry. So the planning is evolving, but the process is also evolving. I think as you can see by the amount of people that are involved in this space and the policy goals of the state, and especially with an eye toward environmental goals, there's a lot more people that are interested in our plans than have traditionally been before. It impacts a lot of people outside of Xcel Energy. So we're really trying to, and we did this in our last plan too, we're trying to increase our focus up front on stakeholder collaboration and certainly continuing throughout this the plan too. But I just was going to walk through a couple of the considerations here at a high level, and Mr. Martin will walk through these in more detail. But So certainly we worked with stakeholders up front. We had 15 stakeholder workshops. We've had several since as well after filing the plan, public meetings. So we tried to account for what we heard people want, what the state is interested in, and incorporate that to the best of our ability into our plan. As I noted earlier, we're also obviously accounting for the capacity and energy needs of our customers. So we're looking at that over the 15-year time frame. We're looking at what the resource options are to meet our customer needs. So like I said, that would be wind and solar, storage, demand-side management as well, so demand response, energy efficiency. So we're looking at all those things, what can meet our customer needs. But we also need to keep in mind that this is not just for one state. We file this. It's an upper Midwest integrated resource plan. So we are filing this in five states. So it's Minnesota, which is certainly the largest state, but also Minnesota, or also North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Michigan all have a say in this plan. So we need to make sure that any plan we put forward is complying with all the states' statutes and rules and commission orders of all five states, in addition to Xcel Energy's own corporate priorities and objectives. And then last, I just want to touch on this because I think it's an important point about the increased internal coordination with this energy transition. It really is touching all areas of Xcel Energy as we try to work together not only with external stakeholders but internal stakeholders, making sure that we're all working together, accounting for all the impacts this has on all areas of our business. So probably for a year and a half before we even filed our plan, we've been having large team meetings with nearly all areas of the company, making sure everybody's aligned and we're all planning for this energy transition appropriately. So we then put all these inputs into our analyses, and we get an array of resource portfolios that could potentially meet our needs, and we ultimately determine one preferred plan that we then put into the resource plan and submit over for a 15-year time horizon. We file it about every 2 to 3 years, and we submit that to the commission for approval. And I've got another slide here on the commission approval process, which is quite robust and extensive, but is just one box represented here. And then ultimately, we implement that plan. And right now, we are in the process of implementing our last approved plan, which is in 2015, which included a very large wind build-out, and we are implementing that right now, for example. So, like I mentioned, we've got we end up with an array of choices of portfolios that could potentially meet our plans, and we look at all those, and we weigh these different priorities to see what is the actual plan we're going to propose. And so we're trying to strike a balance between, I would say, these four key priorities. First is reliability, which has always, of course, been a priority for us, but really with the increase of renewables is something that really is important to us at this point to make sure that any plan that we put forward, we have full confidence it is reliable. We will be able to serve our customer needs at all times. Environmental, certainly for Xcel Energy and our aggressive carbon goals, we want to make sure, and along with the state policy goals, we want to make sure that anything we propose is consistent with that. Cost, you know, consistent with the other folks you heard from today, that's something that's always top of mind. The decisions we make have impacts on our customers. We want to make sure we're doing this in as least cost manner as possible. Then finally, something I haven't touched on but is also equally important is risk, making sure that we've got portfolio diversity so we're not exposed to any one commodity spike or too much market exposure, making sure, again, that we've got a diverse portfolio to minimize that risk for both the company and the customers. So I mentioned before we've had a pretty robust stakeholder engagement process to date. Before we filed, we had 14 workshops. Over 300 interested parties are involved in the resource plan to date. We're trying to not only gather their feedback and their input, but we're also trying to educate. This is a pretty complicated process, so to the extent we can help people understand the implications, the process, the more informed and involved people can be. We also had a series of surveys that we issued to let people give feedback in a different way. And then certainly host communities are always top of mind for us. We understand the implications of having a Xcel Energy plant and host community. And so similar to our work internally and with stakeholders, we're trying to make sure we're working with our host communities in our energy transition. So moving to the last slide for me, the regulatory process. We filed this on July 1st, 2019, with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. And anybody can participate in the docket. So it officially kicked off on July 1st 2019, but anybody can participate via the stakeholder workshops that we had, via the public meetings that the commission has had since we submitted it, a discovery process that's actually been quite involved already to date, and then also there's a series of comments and reply comments in the commission arena. So we've got 13 official interveners and over 520 information requests that we've answered to date in hundreds, I think not quite thousands of public comments, but certainly a very robust record already. And we've only had our initial filing so far. The kind of parties that traditionally are involved range, and it would include, for instance, the Department of Commerce, the Attorney General's Office, our large industrial customers, consumer advocate groups, renewable energy developers, low-income groups, environmental groups. So you could imagine there's quite an array of interests and stakeholders, and so we're doing our best to work with all of these folks and account for everybody's interests to the best of our ability. Next up, we'll be filing a supplemental filing in April, which is to account for some feedback that we've already received from the commission as well as the Department of Commerce and others. And then later this year, those comments, reply comments, and then supplemental comments will evolve, and eventually we would expect a commission decision late this year or more likely in early 2021. So that kind of wraps up the regulatory process. I'll turn it over to PJ from here.
Okay, so first off, just wanted to thank the committee for having us. Really happy to be here and talk through this. Definitely willing to field questions on this. Would assume I'll get a few, but I'm going to talk a little bit about just first our modeling process, relatively complicated, and then I'll move into more details around our preferred plan. So as Bria mentioned, we filed a plan in July of 2019. I'll walk through some of the elements of that plan. So just to start with our modeling process, this is a pretty detailed slide here. I'm not going to walk through all of the detail on it, but thought it would be good to provide just a high level. It's a very long process. We start off with our inputs and assumptions. Those are some of the critical elements that feed into our model. We then run our model using all those inputs and assumptions, and then it spits out a number of different potential paths, plans, which we evaluate. But just to start with the inputs and assumptions, part of the stakeholder process that we had that Bria was talking about, we went back, you know, a year and a half, worked extensively with stakeholders, talked a lot about inputs, assumptions, shared some of the assumptions we were planning to use in the model, got feedback from external parties, and actually even changed some of the assumptions and inputs we were planning to use in the model. So felt that's where the stakeholder process was very beneficial. It helped inform a robust modeling process. Load forecast, fuel price forecast, you can see the whole list that we've got up on the slide there. Again, very, very detailed, a lot of different inputs that we need to work on for the model. When we run the model, what we're trying to do, the traditional resource planning approach, is we're trying to identify what is our least cost option going into the future. How do we design a portfolio over the next 15 years, which our resource plan focuses on a 15-year period, so 2020 to 2034. How do we identify which resource additions we should make in the future that help us, you know, keep costs down for our customers? That's our primary objective. We also explore, and particularly in this resource plan, we explored a number of different baseload scenarios because we have a coal fleet and we have a nuclear fleet. We've announced that we were going to retire a couple of the coal units previously, but we were evaluating our King unit and our Sherco 3 unit and what are the optimal life cycles for those given the market conditions we're seeing. Same with our nuclear plants as well. So that was a critical element of this resource plan, figuring out what we're going to do with existing assets. Do we want to retire them early? Do we want to extend them? That's a big thing we look at. And then just in terms of future resource additions, I have some additional slides that talk through that here, but you know, what future resource additions do we think make sense? What are their costs? Again, how do we adopt a least cost plan that's going to keep rates down for our customers? So look at all of that. Look at a number of different metrics, like Bria had said, you know, on carbon risk, you know, emissions, reliability metrics. Look at all of those considerations and then ultimately put forth a preferred plan. And I'll talk through that in detail in some coming slides here. Before I get to that, though, I'd like to talk quickly, again, at a high level, As a resource planner, it's really important for us to try to retain portfolio diversity. As many of you, I'm sure, know, and anybody who has a retirement account, I'm sure you have brokers or advisors who recommend that you diversify your portfolio to minimize the amount of risk that you're facing in the market. The same principle holds true here. As we're designing future generation portfolios, we don't want to become over-dependent on one particular resource. So that's where we try to ensure that we're maintaining a diversified mix of resources. And really, when you think about the resources that are important to us, there's kind of three general categories, and you can see them on the slide here. So we have fuel saving, you know, variable renewables, so wind, solar. We have firm low-carbon resources. We think it's really important to have firm dispatchable resources available on our system for periods when we have, you know, renewable droughts and maybe not enough storage to carry us through and serve our load reliably. And then lastly, the third category is fast burst resources, which is your demand response, which is load control. So, you know, cycling air conditioning units, or if you have commercial and industrial customers that are willing to voluntarily shed load, those types of resources. And then battery storage would fall into that category as well. Right now, the technology we're seeing from battery storage, we included a generic 4-hour battery storage resource, meaning that, you know, it can discharge for a period of four hours. Technology's improving, costs are coming down. We're hoping that the duration of discharge that battery storage provides continues to improve in the future. But right now, we just see, you know, significant periods of need where you have 12, sometimes 24 hours where renewables have not consistently produced. And in order for you to serve your load only with batteries, you'd have to significantly overbuild the amount of batteries on your system to help serve that load. And I have a slide later on that helps illustrate that point a little bit. Again, just some a precursor to getting into the actual preferred plan. Just to talk real quickly about, you know, what we're seeing. You know, as I mentioned, we design all of those inputs that feed into our model. But just thinking about how our model works at a high level, I think the general cost that we're seeing for resources that you see on the slide here really helps conceptualize why certain resources get selected over others as we move into the future. So the biggest point we're trying to convey on this slide, I think, is that utility-scale renewables are really economic and have become least-cost resources, and I think that's no surprise to anybody in this room. We've been adding a significant amount of wind in recent years. We're in the process of growing our wind portfolio and almost doubling our wind portfolio because we've seen prices in the market that have been, you know, in the teens per megawatt hour, you know, low 20s per megawatt hour. So very economic energy that we can add to our system, and it really kind of displaces some of the other resource production on our system. You know, if coal is higher cost production, if gas is higher cost production, that lower cost energy displaces it, and our customers realize fuel savings. So really, again, wind, generally we've seen wind in the $20 to $25 per megawatt hour range. Coal, and when I show thermal costs here, the costs that you see here are really production costs. So we're talking about fuel and like operations and maintenance cost. So we kind of see our coal and our natural gas combined cycle resources in a similar range. Gas prices obviously move around from time to time. We've seen very low gas prices this winter because we haven't really seen a sustained cold weather event or a number of events impact the United States. So generally, coal and combined cycle are in the, you know, $25 to $35 range. And you see the MISO market, if you look at the average kind of energy prices in the MISO market, that's generally the range we're seeing. So those units kind of help set the marginal price in the market. Nuclear also has prices that are similar to that coal combined cycle range. If you look just at production costs, they're in the $30 to $35 per megawatt hour range. Utility-scale solar at this point is a little bit higher. We're seeing prices in the low 40s per megawatt hour, so we've definitely seen prices come down significantly in recent years. We're hoping that trend continues. We anticipate that trend will continue. But right now, part of a lot of questions we get asked are, why aren't we out there adding utility-scale solar in mass right now like we are with wind? And I think the answer is what you see here. You know, we can add wind below an average fuel cost. So we can add wind at $15. The average fuel cost here is $25. We're saving customers money. Solar at $45, you know, it doesn't make sense to add $45 solar when your average fuel cost is $25 because, you know, it's not helping to save customers money. And we don't have a capacity need, which is part of that as well. The two other resource categories you see here, so community solar gardens are on this chart in the about $100, $150 range. Definitely higher costs. Part of the reason that we're not big advocates of growing the community solar garden program, when you look at the cost of those resources relative to some of our other options, we think it makes more sense to pursue the utility scale options. And then biomass, we have some legacy biomass contracts and some owned biomass resources as well. Those have historically been higher cost. If you look at forecasted costs for new biomass resources, those are somewhat relatively high cost as well. So we don't, in our resource plan, we do not include a generic biomass option, so we don't evaluate new biomass resources. Our preferred plan, now we get to get into the preferred plan. I'll try to move through this quickly. I know we've kind of reached close to the end of the time here, but hopefully many of you have heard some of the elements of our preferred plan. We've proposed to extend one of our nuclear units. Our Monticello unit was supposed to retire in 2030. We've proposed extending that to 2040. On the coal side, we're proposing early retirement of all of our coal resources by 2030. So King will retire in 28, Sherco 3 and 30. Previously, King was a 2037 retirement date, and Sherco 3 was 2040. A change that we need to make in an upcoming filing in April, we had included Mankato combined cycle acquisition. We had proposed acquiring that unit. The Minnesota Commission did not approve that. So we need to adjust that in our modeling and submit new modeling that reflects that unit as a power purchase agreement and not an owned resource. So that's one change that's pending right now. But we're also planning on continuing to pursue our Sherco combined cycle as a replacement for all the coal that's going away in the Becker area. On the firm peaking side, we're adding about 1,700 megawatts of placeholder resources at this point that we're calling CTs because that's a firm dispatchable resource. However, we've indicated that once we get out to that time frame, we're willing to look at battery storage, we're looking to look at demand response, energy efficiency, a number of different resource options to serve that need. But we think market rules are going to change as we move out into the future. We think MISO is going to evolve some of the constructs they have and make reliability requirements more stringent. So we're kind of anticipating some changes there and waiting to see what MISO comes forward with. On the wind and solar side, we're adding about 1,200 megawatts of wind to help replace some PPA expirations that are occurring. On the solar side, that's really one of the highlights of the plan. We're adding about 4,000 megawatts of solar by 2034. So think there'll be a huge solar opportunity with those costs coming down and some of the complementary characteristics that resource has with wind. Since we already have an abundance of wind in the portfolio, kind of matching up with a somewhat equal amount of solar, we think will yield benefits. And then lastly, we made some really big announcements around demand-side management. We're really increasing the amount of energy efficiency that we're pursuing. And then we also met a commission order to add some incremental demand response by 2023. I can get through this slide very quickly, I think, but I like this part, pie chart. I think it shows the great story that is the resource plan that we provided in July. A lot of folks, a lot of external stakeholders have really keyed in on the Sherco combined cycle, and we understand that that's a controversial element of our plan. But I think if you look at this pie chart, you can really see we are pursuing a vast amount of renewable resources and energy efficiency and demand response. Those are obviously clean resources. That is the bulk of what we're proposing to add to our system in the future. Yes, we've acknowledged that we do think gas plays a role and we need to add some gas resources, but when you think about the fact we're retiring an entire coal fleet, we also have about 1,500 megawatts of combustion turbine retirements as well. We're really just kind of replacing some of the gas that's going away, and then if you think about all the coal retirements, that's essentially being replaced with renewables. So we think this is a really good plan. And again, when you think about those three different categories that I'd introduced for resource types and the roles that those play in our system, I think it really creates a portfolio that we're proud of. I think I only have three or so more slides, so I'll try to move through these quickly. This is our rainbow slide, as we like to call it. So this just shows the composition or makeup of our generation portfolio from 2020 through 2034. So I think what's helpful looking at this chart is if you kind of just compare 2020 to 2034 and see how our portfolio is really evolving over time. You can see the huge amount of solar growth that's occurring. We have very little solar in our system now, you know, only about 1,000 megawatts. That grows to over 5,000 megawatts by 2034. The amount of wind on our system stays about the same. As I mentioned, we're adding 1,200 megawatts of wind, but that's just essentially replacing some of the power purchase agreement expirations that we see. You can see that we're adding a lot of the energy efficiency in that fluorescent pink color on with the bottom part of the chart. We're generally retaining our nuclear portfolio. And again, the thing that I like to highlight on this chart is if you look at the two gas segments, so there's a combustion turbine and a combined cycle, both in blue, and in 2034 they both say 2.7. If you compare the amount of gas in the portfolio in 2034 to 2020, you can see it's growing a little bit, but not significantly. So again, we're adding a lot of renewables, we're adding a lot of energy efficiency, we're pretty much maintaining the same amount of gas, and we're eliminating all the coal. So I think a pretty good story. The last two slides I have, during our IRP process, we worked with a consultant named E3. I think it stands for environmental economy and energy. I believe that's the three E's. But they're out of San Francisco. They're a pretty respected consulting group. They performed the storage study that I think the legislature had ordered last year and recently presented in the last few months. So we engaged them. Obviously, we understand that our integrated resource plan draws a lot of interest. It's a somewhat controversial thing at times. We wanted to bring in a professional consultant who could offer an independent perspective. They have a number of resource planning models that they use that are different from the strategist model that we use, so we thought it would be good to kind of try to use them to run their model, to test some different scenarios, but also to hopefully validate some of the key conclusions that we were reaching in our resource planning process. And we think generally they did that, but one of the key analyses they did for us was looking at 100% renewable system. We didn't do any specific modeling looking at 100% renewable system. Again, our planning period only extends out to 2034. So we think the real drastic move towards 100% is going to occur beyond that. But anyway, E3 looked at by 2045, if Xcel needs to get to a 100% renewable portfolio or close to 100% renewable portfolio, What would a portfolio look like, assuming no fossil fuel is longer in the portfolio? And I think that was kind of one of the most interesting takeaways for me. And just to talk about the bar chart at the bottom a little bit, if you look at the bottom bar in that chart, the biggest one, that just shows in 2045, if we completely eliminated fossil fuels from our portfolio and went only wind, only solar, only storage, that we would have to grow our generation portfolio from about 13 to 14 gigawatts right now, that's how big it is today, to over 60 gigawatts. So it just highlights the fact that in order to serve your load reliably with variable resources and storage, you have to significantly overbuild the amount of those resources to reliably serve the load, to reliably store that renewable energy and shift it to periods when you can actually serve load and the renewables aren't there. They calculated that portfolio would cost customers an incremental over $4 billion a year. So that was a pretty eye-opening takeaway for us and thought it was analysis that was very interesting, to say the least. But getting back to our resource plan, the 100% renewable analysis they did was very interesting. That kind of stood on its own. as I mentioned before, what we really wanted from them was a validation of some of the conclusions we were reaching in our own modeling, and we think we got that from them here. In their modeling, they also showed that early coal retirement made economic sense, and that was a path that we should pursue, so we were glad to see that. In their modeling, they also identified that nuclear extension looked like an attractive option and was something that helped confirm the conclusions we were reaching in our own modeling as well. And then lastly, you know, per that previous slide, they showed that in order to still achieve significant carbon reductions but do so in the most economic manner, gas is going to be an important part of the portfolio. Yes, gas will run less in the future. Capacity factors will drop as you add more renewables, as you add storage to the system. But still having that gas so that you don't have to significantly overbuild the amount of storage is going to be really important for us to continue to help keep costs down for customers. So we felt good that E3 reached the same general conclusions, and again, we're proud of the plan we put forward. So with that, I think that was my last slide. Thank you.
Okay. I do have some questions here for you, but you need to leave.
Yeah, in a couple minutes, but is that okay?
Let's start with Representative Hornstein's question, then we'll go to Representative Long, and then Representative Brzezinski.
Well, thank you, Ms. Shea and Mr. Martin. That was very, very helpful, just really clear and well presented, so I appreciate that a lot. And if you don't have the answer to this question at your fingertips, I totally understand. But I have always been concerned that garbage incineration is considered in state law as renewable energy and counted as renewable energy. And I know that you purchase from the HERC facility, and I don't know, again, if you have this off your fingertips, but what is the cost per megawatt hour of that energy, and how many megawatts do you actually get from that facility?
Sure. So I think the cost per megawatt hour would be trade secret. I'm not sure that's something we could share because it's kind of a
trade secret.
It's a contractual, you know, typically we don't share the actual prices of our power purchase agreement.
Okay.
For competitive reasons. So I'm not sure we can share that information, but I think the size of the unit, if I remember correctly, I think it's about 20 megawatts. So 20. Just
okay.
Yep, 20 megawatts. So just relative to the size of our system, so we have a peak load that's a little bit over 9,000 megawatts. So very small relative to that. And if you think about some of our coal units, our Sherco coal units are around 700 megawatts. So okay. Much smaller unit or resource than some of those others.
Okay. Well, and just a very quick follow-up, Madam Chair. So in terms of this, you're not being able to share the cost, what would be the competitor? Is it a different form of energy? Is it someone else that's producing, you know, the incinerated energy? What would be the competitor in this case?
Sure. So, I mean, I think just generally, you know, we're constantly negotiating with power purchase, you know, folks and anyone that we have historical relationships with. You know, we have a number of PPA contracts. You know, Manitoba Hydro is one. We have a number of wind and solar PPAs as well. So I think just generally, we don't like to share that information because then other competitors know exactly what we're buying power for, and they can therefore adjust pricing in future negotiations or future offers to us.
Okay,
so that's kind of the thinking.
Okay, thank you. I get that. But then just one last quick question. I one of the graphics that you had in the presentation I thought was very effective is you did have relative cost of other you know, of all the different sources. So and then, you know, biomass was one of the more expensive ones, as I recall. So, but you can sort of conglomerate these just general kinds of things into a graphic like that, correct?
There's exactly, no yes. As long as it's aggregated information, you're not identifying a specific contract. That's where we can share that information. But identifying a specific contract and the specific pricing is something that I've had my hand slapped for before.
Okay.
So I don't want to do that again.
Okay, got it. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that clarification.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up for Representative Hornstein then. So do you have a sense for what the aggregated, where waste energy would fit in an aggregated sense on your chart? Just rough dollar per megawatt hour.
So are you talking about the HERC facility?
No, I'm not talking about a specific facility. I'm just saying if you were to put waste energy on this chart, do you have a rough sense for where it would fall?
Sure. I can tell you that the HERC facility, the contract pricing for that is much lower than what you see for the biomass bar on that chart.
Is it fair to say it's higher than nuclear, combined cycle, coal, wind, and utility scale solar?
Yes, that's correct as well.
Okay. I needed an attorney to help.
Speaking on this chart, too, you mentioned that utility scale solar costs are coming down. I assume that this chart is current costs and not projected costs over the 15-year window. And when would you anticipate that utility scale solar would become least costs?
Sure, that's correct. It is current costs. We're anticipating that, again, if you think about our capacity needs, so if you think about the chart that Bria showed, that showed we have some excess capacity for the next few years, and then in the mid-20s, we go capacity deficient. If you remember the, I can slide back to it here. So this chart right here, you can see for a number of years with the blue that, you know, we're in excess of meeting our customer load requirements. So we have excess capacity in 2025-ish, 2026. That's when we're going to start needing to add capacity. Capacity value is a good chunk of the value that you can ascribe to resources. So solar really needs to have some capacity value to us for us to justify it. Because like I said, if you're looking just on the energy side, $45 compared to buying at the market at $25 doesn't really make sense. But if you can say, you know, there's capacity value as well that you're getting, that's when you can justify solar. So that's why in our plan you see we're starting to add solar around 2025.
Be least cost in about 5 years. So then for wind, this chart shows that it's least cost now, and I understand that you're doing a 15-year plan, but you're also file IRPs every 3 years, right? So you'll be going back to the public, roughly. So you'll be going back to the Public Utilities Commission in a few years. Over the course of the next 3 years, are you proposing any new wind? I know you're doing some repowering, but are you proposing any new wind? And if not, why not, since it's the lowest cost?
Sure. So, again, this is kind of current wind. If you look at the assumptions we're making in the resource plan modeling, we're anticipating that new wind, new greenfield wind, that is, you know, like you said, we're doing some repowers. We've already kind of contracted or purchased a number of existing wind sites. What we're seeing in the MISO interconnection queue, and I think you all had a meeting a couple days ago where the MISO folks came in and talked a little bit about that. They have a transmission interconnection queue that new wind projects have to basically submit into that queue, and MISO will study the impacts of a new project and identify if transmission upgrade costs are needed. What we've seen from them is that there's been excess transmission capacity because of all the big transmission projects that have been built out over the last 10 or 15 years. But just in the last 6 months to a year, we've seen that interconnection queue kind of get clogged up and hit a roadblock. And new greenfield projects have been identified to have like hundreds of millions of dollars of transmission cost upgrades. So our forward-looking view of wind is that it's going to be much more difficult to add new greenfield wind in the future because we're ascribing some transmission cost to those resources in our model, and then our model sees higher cost wind versus solar, selects solar, doesn't necessarily select new greenfield wind because of those transmission costs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what I'm hearing you say is that if the transmission costs were lower, that your model would be selecting wind within the next three-year IRP timeframe?
Possibly. As long as the cost of the wind is underneath that kind of average market cost of around $25 or so, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you showed the E3 analysis and their assessment of coal, and you mentioned that both you and E3 agreed that coal generation early retirements are going to be cost-effective for your customers, and you are proposing 2037 and 2040. Wondering if you and E3 modeled earlier retirements on those dates, and if so, if those would be more cost-effective than retirements in 2037 and 2040.
Sure. That's a great question, and we've gotten that in a number of forums. Our thinking with the retirement dates is if you look at how our coal retirements are staged, our Sherco 2 unit is supposed to close in 2023, Sherco 1 in 2026, King in 28, Sherco 3 in 30. So the thought was that was kind of a nice sequential retirement to kind of ensure that there's no, you know, massive removal of coal from the system and reliability impacts. We wanted to take a staged approach, and we were also concerned about the community impacts as well in Oak Park Heights and Becker. Working with those communities, obviously, with some of the economic development opportunities that we've identified, but we just really felt that that was a nice staged approach. It gave those communities time to plan and allow for an orderly transition.
So that's helpful. So those are all valid reasons. I'm not hearing cost as the reason why you just didn't decide to retire those plants earlier.
So we did not look at earlier retirement dates. Those were the scenarios we looked at.
Okay. And then you have the Sherco combined cycle plant in here as a preferred alternative for this plan. I know that this body has been involved in that discussion in the past and has we have instructions in statute to the Public Utilities Commission on that. I've heard conflicting things on whether those instructions give the Public Utilities Commission discretion over whether or not to approve the Sherco combined cycle plant, and I'm curious if you have an opinion on that.
Sure. That's a good question. I might defer to her, but just real quickly on the modeling side, I will say the commission has ordered us to study different sizes for that combined cycle unit in the upcoming April supplemental filing we're going to make, so we're going to look at, you know, some smaller options, and I think maybe one larger option as well. So that is additional analysis that will be forthcoming.
Sure, certainly. thanks for the question, Representative. Madam Chair, the statute does provide an opportunity to bring the costs to the commission. So certainly, there's a prudent standard there. So the commission certainly will have a chance to weigh in on the Sherco CC.
Thank you. And one follow-up relatedly for the Monticello nuclear proposal that's a part of your preferred alternatives. Does the commission also have a discretion over whether or not to approve a Monticello nuclear extension?
Yep, they do, Madam Chair, Representative Wong. We would be required to file a certificate of need with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. There's also a federal process, but yes, there would be a regulatory process sort of similar here to the integrated resource plan that would fold out in the next in the coming years. But yes, they will be they would be involved in the approval process of that.
Thank you. Thanks very much for your help.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at the slide that talks about current generation resources economics, it really kind of looks like the slide shows kind of the differences between the cost between resources for dispatchable resources and then non-dispatchable resources. What's the difference in market value to these resources? So obviously from a basic cost standpoint, you've got a value that can be attributed to something that can be dispatched instantly, and then you have non-dispatchable resources such as wind and solar that they're just not. And like from a value standpoint, how does that figure it out?
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative. I think that's a good question. I think that really highlights, folks may have heard like resources talked about on a levelized cost, you know, the levelized cost of wind versus the levelized cost of a combustion turbine versus the levelized cost of a combined cycle. I think that raises an important point. It's very difficult to evaluate resources against each other on a levelized cost basis when you're getting very different attributes from some resources versus another. So that's where, you know, I hesitate to evaluate the levelized cost of a combined cycle or a CT against the levelized cost of wind, because if you think back to my pie chart of resource types, you know, you're evaluating one resource that is a firm dispatchable resource that provides kind of full capacity value against another resource that is very cheap energy but doesn't necessarily provide that capacity value and is not necessarily there at all hours of the year. So that's where it's very difficult to evaluate resources on a levelized cost basis. Here, this chart kind of just tries to focus on energy value. So this isn't capturing, you know, fully loaded costs or levelized costs or capacity value. This is just kind of on an energy basis. these are the resources that are most competitive right now, and this is kind of why our model is selecting the resources that it is.
Thank you. And then, you know, just kind of a from a comparison, it looks like, you know, wind is at 20, gas is at 35. You know, we think, you know, it's kind of a misleading chart in the fact that it says, well, it's cheaper, but, you know, gas more is essentially, and coal and nuclear are much more valuable because of the fact that it's actually dispatchable. So, and then just kind of one last question, kind of what, you know, let's say this moves forward, this plan, you know, kind of what are your thoughts? Obviously, this is probably not a question to be answered today, but, you know, what is going to happen to the coal when you guys stop burning it? You know, is it due for export? I mean, I think, folks, we can all agree that from a market standpoint, we can say we're going to get rid of this coal resource, but it's still going to get burnt. It's still going to generate electricity someplace on the globe. And then also from a standpoint of just reliability and the rest, you know, there are state laws out there. You looked at, in my, just kind of on the newspaper math, it looks like about 35,000 acres of solar is going to be potentially in your future. You know, I would ask for you to make a commitment to generate those resources within XL territory that is currently underneath your purview, but also look at the standpoint that maybe you don't go out further than your resource that is currently. So if you're replacing it with a Sherco, that you don't move it past, from a transmission standpoint, past where it's already being transferred from. And also, you know, protecting of land things and the rest from a state law already dictates that you do not use prime farmland for those implementations of those resources. So I'd ask as a company that you make those commitments to, you know, yeah, do that. So thank you.
I'd like to follow up with the question from Representative Long on your current generations, the snapshot of costs now, as I understand it.
Correct.
But you're projecting that utility scale solar will be dropping. It would be good for us to see your projected drop rate and what you see over the course of this resource plan, because this only tells me a little bit. And if you would share that with us so we can put it in folks' packets, that would be great.
Sure. Madam Chair, absolutely. We have an appendix document within our resource plan that provides those forecasts, so we could get that for you all. We are in the process of updating those numbers for our April supplement, so we can provide you what was filed with the modeling in July of last year. The update will be coming in April, so we can make sure you get that as well.
So I'm sorry that Representative Swazinski left, because he was suggesting where you put your resources, and that may be a discussion we will have, because I would put on the table that we have wells, community municipal wells in Minnesota that are in desperate need of protection. Solar, wind would be a great protector. And so it would be a double benefit to the community to protect their drinking water. So I just didn't want one suggestion to be on the table. You needed two. So I don't see other questions from members. I do appreciate all the testimony this morning, all the education. It's a good way to get started. Our next hearing is on the 13th, and we'll be talking about the impact of climate change on Minnesota's water resources. Oh, I'm sorry. There is some public comment. I was missing that. Is Isaac Orr here? Yes. I'm sorry I missed that. On the,
it's okay.
Do you want to do it now, or do you want to do it at another time?
All right. Thank you for letting me testify, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Isaac Orr, and I'm a policy fellow
specializing in energy and environmental policy at Center of the American Experiment. And again, just thank you for letting me squeeze this in. Our organization has done some preliminary modeling of Xcel's preferred plan, and I'd just like to share some of those results with you. The cost of prematurely closing down Xcel's coal units and replacing them with a combination of repowered wind, solar, and natural gas could cost Xcel ratepayers more than $40 billion through 2050, which equates to an additional cost of $1,100 for each Xcel customer, including residential, commercial, and industrial customers. These values, which represent the unsubsidized cost of these energy resources, would increase electricity prices by more than $25 per megawatt hour, an increase of more than 25% compared to 2018 prices. According to the economic modeling software Implan, such an increase in electricity costs would destroy approximately 11,000 Minnesota jobs. We believe these assumptions are conservative because we assume the firm capacity Xcel will need after shutting the last of their coal plants will be provided by natural gas power plants and not battery storage, as Xcel mentioned just a few minutes ago. We made this assumption because building enough battery storage to satisfy 1 hour of Xcel's average electricity demand would cost $869 million, bringing the cost of 24 hours of battery storage to nearly $21 billion, which would increase electricity costs for Minnesota families by about $265 per year for 20 years based on conservative estimates for battery costs. While this proposal would impose enormous costs on Minnesotans, it would make no measurable impact on future global temperatures. Xcel's preferred plan would avert approximately 8 million metric tons of carbon dioxide per year. This brings the cost of each ton of carbon dioxide averted to about $118, and this number jumps to $158 if the lives of Xcel's nuclear plants are not extended. The cost far exceeds the highest social cost of carbon cost established by the Minnesota regulators, which is $69.48 per ton. Despite the enormous cost, the plan would have no measurable environmental benefits. Using the same assumptions on global temperature that the Obama administration used for the Clean Power Plan, Xcel's preferred plan would avert 0.0002 degrees Celsius by 2100, which is an amount too small to measure. It would be far more beneficial for ratepayers to utilize these units until the end of their useful lifetime, so their coal units, sometime in the late 2030s, and replace them with Generation 4 nuclear plants, than to spend billions of dollars on solar, wind, and the required transmission and natural gas backups to provide electricity when the weather doesn't cooperate. Thanks very much.
With that, members, we are adjourned.